I left off last Sunday after we covered the first battle in the epic war in the Garden of Eden. And if you remember, that was the war that was the beginning of the war, basically. After Satan was cast out of heaven, he focused his energy on Adam and Eve to bring down the man and the woman. And to bring down the man, he first went to the woman, deceived her, and then by deceiving her, he was able to get to the man. But then, if you remember, in Genesis 3:15, as part of God's curse, he made a prophecy, and he said that the seed of the woman that would be born would bruise the serpent's head, and the serpent would bruise the seed, the woman's seed's heel. And this was the first prophecy of the Lord Jesus Christ. So at this point, Satan now knows that there is coming a seed, a descendant of the woman, that is ultimately going to be his demise. It's going to bruise his head. But which one is it? And we're going to get into the first of those seeds of the woman, and we're going to see how Satan then attacks that first seed, the first righteous person that's born of Eve. Satan goes after him because, I mean, if the prophecy's made that it's going to be the seed of the woman, you may as well get started right away and try to take out the seed as fast as you can, and this is what Satan's going to do. So this whole section, this is going to begin a large section in this series on the war against the prophesied Messiah, because Satan ultimately wants to stop the Messiah from being born, because the Messiah is that seed of the woman. So the first casualty in this war ends up being a man named Abel. If you turn to Genesis chapter 4, 1 through 2, we see here that Adam and Eve have two children right off the bat. Doesn't say how long it took them, but probably not long. Genesis 4, 1 through 2, it says, "And Adam knew Eve his wife, and she conceived and bare Cain, and said, I have gotten a man from the Lord. And she again bare his brother Abel. And Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground." So the first two boys are born. You got Cain and Abel. And everybody knows the story of Cain and Abel pretty well. And I won't go into great detail about it, but I will cover some of the high points as we go through this. Now, the thing about Cain was, he was a child of the devil. And I'm assuming the devil knows who his own kids are. He can figure that out. If nothing else, just by their fruits you shall know them. The devil's smart enough, he can figure that out. So Cain's a child of the devil, but I'll just give you a verse that flat out states this in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 12. So just think about it. If Cain's a child of the devil doesn't have to worry about Cain, right? Cain's certainly not going to be the seed of the woman that's going to bruise his head, because Cain's on Satan's side. 1 John 3 and verse 12. It says, "Not as Cain, who was of that wicked one, and slew his brother. And wherefore slew he him? Because his own works were evil, and his brother's righteous." And we're going to look into what this is speaking of here in just a second in Genesis chapter 4. So Cain was of that wicked one, and that wicked one is another name for the devil. Now Abel, on the other hand, is a child of God. Look at Matthew 23 and verse 35. There's a couple different passages here in the New Testament that will prove to us that Abel was a child of God. Matthew 23 and verse 35. We're going to see which one of these boys that the devil is going to go after. Matthew 23 and verse 35, Jesus said to the Pharisees, "That upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom ye slew between the temple and the altar." You notice that adjective there describing Abel? Righteous Abel. Abel was a righteous man, righteous by the blood of Christ that was imputed unto him ahead of time, based on what God knew that Christ would do on Abel's behalf. You can read about that in Romans 3 and verse 25. Sometimes, I just mention that because sometimes the question comes up, how could a person be righteous back in the Old Testament before Christ died for their sins? And the answer is that God looked ahead and knew that Christ would die for Abel in covenant, and then could apply that blood retroactively to Abel's sins. And that's how that works. Romans 3:25 talks about that. Also in Hebrews 11 and verse 4, Hebrews 11 and verse 4, we're told here that Abel made his sacrifice by faith. It says, "By faith," Hebrews 11, 4, "by faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it he being dead yet speaketh." So we know that faith is impossible for somebody who's not a child of God anyway. And secondly, it says that by this offering by faith, he showed witness or evidence that he was righteous. And this is a good text that shows us that faith is the evidence of eternal salvation. Good works are the evidence of eternal salvation. Verse 1 says that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Well, eternal life is not seen, and faith is the evidence of that eternal life which is not seen. So, therefore, Satan, just seeing the fruit in Abel's life, seeing Abel making this sacrifice by faith, seeing that Abel's a godly man, Abel's got to die now. Because he knows that the woman's seed is going to bruise his head, and for all he knows, it could be her first child, could be the first generation, it could be a long time from now, but one thing's for certain, got to get rid of Abel. And that's exactly what happens. Cain ends up slaying his brother Abel because he was righteous and Cain was wicked, as we read there in 1 John 3 and verse 12. Now let's go back. Let's just read about it in Genesis 4, 3 and 4. Genesis 4, 3 and 4. Here's how it happened. It says, in process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord, and Abel he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect, and Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. So compare that with what we just read there in Hebrews, that by faith Abel made this offering. And we're told in Romans chapter 10 that faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. And we saw there in Matthew 23 that Abel was a prophet. The prophet Abel to the prophet Zechariah, the first prophet to the last prophet there. That verse we looked at in Matthew 23:35. So Abel being a prophet means that God was speaking directly to him and giving him information, right? So God told him how he wanted the sacrifice to be made. Abel did it by faith. Cain just did whatever he felt like. I'll get into that in just a second. And then ultimately, and we'll read about this in just a second, but Cain ends up killing Abel for what he did, for his religion. And I want you to notice, the first battle after the Garden of Eden was a battle of true religion versus false religion. The first battle, so you got the Garden of Eden, that's the first battle after the fall from heaven. And then after that, here the stage is set for the rest of human history. The battle is going to be true religion versus false religion, because this was an act of religion. It was an offering unto God, and Abel did it the way that God said. Cain did not do it the way that God said. Cain kills Abel. And this is how it happens down through the centuries. You see, Cain was a pragmatist. He worshiped God with whatever was most convenient to him, and his offering was rejected. Because Cain, remember what it said there of Cain? It said that he was a tiller of the ground, and what did Cain bring? Of the fruit of the ground. It's easy enough. I'm a tiller of the ground. I've got this stuff on hand. Probably had some extra I didn't really need. I'll bring this to God for an offering. Instead of taking and trading that fruit of the ground with Abel to get a firstling of the flock to make a blood sacrifice, that requires a lot of work and effort. I'll just give God whatever I have instead of giving him what he asked for, you see. So the Lord was not happy about that. He doesn't like pragmatism in religion. He doesn't like your bright ideas. He likes you to do it the way that he says, even if it's a little more difficult to do it the way that he says, that's what he wants to do, right? I've used the example of music before, but we have Judy here, which is a great pianist, right? And she could play the piano well, and it could maybe help us to sing and maybe help us to stay in tune a little more, though I think we sound pretty good. But we could be pragmatic and say, you know what, this might help us out. But God doesn't want that. God doesn't want our bright ideas. God wants us to do it the way that he says, even though it might be a little more difficult to do it that way, because maybe it's a little harder to stay in tune, or maybe we can't sing a new song that we haven't learned very easily. You see, but God doesn't want pragmatism. He wants us to do the way that he says to do it. And like I said, this set the pattern for the future of world history in Satan's battle against God and his people. The followers of Satan's religion would persecute and kill the followers of God's religion. And you look through history, the Roman Empire and then the Catholic Church for hundreds and thousands of years even, at least, well, over a thousand years, God's people were persecuted by the followers of Satan. And the interesting thing was the followers of Satan called themselves the same thing as the people that they persecuted called themselves. Christians killing Christians, right? the first one was in air quotes, the second one wasn't, because the second people were really the Christians that were being killed. The first ones were those that called themselves Christians, the Catholics. So for the time being now, Satan has stemmed off his demise by the murder of Abel. Because remember, it's a seed of the woman. The woman at this point's only had two seeds, and one of them's wicked, one of them's in Satan's camp already, and the other one's dead. So for right now, Satan's good to go. He has nobody to worry about. It appears to me that Satan began building his army through Cain to war against the woman's seed. Because if you're wise, whenever there's not a direct battle happening, you want to be sharpening your sword, you want to be preparing and training. It appears that Satan began to prepare. He went off, Cain, that is, went off to the land of Nod to build a city. We read about in Genesis 4, 16 through 17. I actually didn't even read. Why don't I just read the account there of Cain and Abel? I made reference to it. I didn't really even finish it. In verse 6, it says, "And the Lord said unto Cain, Why art thou wroth, and why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him." Even though Cain was wicked, he was still the firstborn, and God would have still given him the dominion over Abel if he would have just done what God said. "And Cain talked with Abel his brother. And it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and slew him." You see, he took him out to the field. "Let's have a little talk, Abel. I just want to discuss this matter of religion. Let's just have a friendly dialogue here." But he had something else going on. He killed him. "And the Lord said unto Cain, Where is Abel thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. And now art thou cursed from the earth, which has opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt thou be in the earth." Similar curse that his father Adam had. "And Cain said unto the Lord, My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the earth, and from thy face shall I be hid, and I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond in the earth. And it shall come to pass that every one that findeth me shall slay me. And the Lord said unto him, Therefore, whosoever slayeth Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord set a mark upon Cain, lest any finding him should kill him. And Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod in the east of Eden. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bare Enoch. And he builded a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch." So Cain then gets banished. He goes out to the land of Nod and with his wife, and he builds a city. Now, some people would use this as an argument against the biblical account and say, well, where did Cain get his wife? He went off to the land of Nod and found a wife. Where did he get the wife if you know, we're never told about God creating other people on the earth? His wife was his sister, right? Had to be his sister. It doesn't say that Adam and Eve had daughters, but it does say later on that they had sons and daughters. And it doesn't have to give us that detail. We can just put it together that he married his sister, and there was no prohibition against that at that time. But anyway, so Cain goes out, and he builds a city there in the land of Nod. Now Cain's great-great-great-grandson, Lamech, then, he becomes the first recorded bigamist. We read that in verses 18 and 19. See, we're seeing here the working of Satan already. "And unto Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begat Mahujael, and Mahujael begat Methusael, and Methusael begat Lamech. And Lamech took unto him two wives. The name of the one was Ada, and the name of the other Zillah." So right here is Satan's first attack on God's institution of marriage. This is the original attack right here. It only happened just a few generations from the very beginning of time. It didn't take long. Satan, we think that this attack on marriage is new. It's not new, right? The children of the devil have been doing this forever, from the very beginning. God said one man and one woman, right? From the very beginning, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, not his wives, but his wife. And Lamech doesn't do that. Now, Lamech then follows in the footsteps of his great-great-great-granddaddy, and he murders a man, verses 23 and 24. You see, the working of Satan. "And Lamech said unto his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. Hearken unto my speech, for I have slain a man to my wounding and a young man to my hurt. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold." I always just found that funny when he says, "Hear my voice, ye wives of Lamech." It'd be like me saying to Seth, "Hear my wife, ye, or hear my voice, ye wife of Chad." Like, it's just strange way to address your wife. But anyway, but he killed a man. Doesn't say why, but following in the footsteps of his great 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 granddaddy. Now Cain's descendants were cunning in agriculture, in music, and in industry. We read about that in verses 20 through 22. And Adah bare Jabal. He was the father of such as dwell in tents and such as have cattle. So agriculture. So here are some of the areas that Satan seems to be specializing in through the sons of Cain. So he's a big agriculture bigwig. And his brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all such as handle the harp and organ. So he is musically talented. So think about how much evil Satan has accomplished through music. Now, there's good music out there and there's bad music out there. And unfortunately, there's a lot more bad music out there than good music. But just think about what Satan has done to us through music. And I've noticed this so much lately. I'll hear a song in a store, or when I was back home with my brother in the garage, he was playing this garbage, and it's probably not even bad by the world standards, but playing the stuff that I used to listen to. And I would listen to the words of that stuff and realize, this stuff is evil. Like that song, "I Want to Be a Rock Star." I forget, Nickelback or somebody. Older people probably don't know what that is, and I hope the younger people don't either. But anyway, that song is just terrible. And I was listening to the words of it as he was singing this thing, and it is such a catchy tune. It's unbelievably catchy. I mean, it's like a powerful, draw-you-in tune. And talking about hookers and prostitutes and having your drug dealer on speed dial and all this stuff. It's crazy. And this is the stuff that young kids are listening to. And it's no wonder that they're so messed up, because they look up to these guys. Just think about it. The devil's people back here were the ones that were the father of such that handle harp and organ. It's just interesting that the devil, he has a hand in music. I'm not against music in general, but there's a lot of evil music out there that you should be really careful about listening to yourself and with your kids. And then the thing is, it's something about music. You get the tune in your head and you can't get it out. And I have had tunes in my head, and I'm in my head, horrible music is going through my mind, and it just drives me up the wall. It's hard. And then I try to get a hymn in my head to block that one out. But anyway, we see that Satan was, he was involved in music from the beginning. And in industry, verse 22. And Zillah, she also bare Tubal, an instructor of every artificer in brass and iron. And the sister of Tubal Cain was Naamah. So here you have an artificer in brass and iron, an industrial man. So it's interesting here where you see Satan. He's focusing his efforts on the things of this world. And if he can master agriculture, you get a lot of control over people. If you can master music, you can get into people's heads. And if you can master industry, then you can affect technology. You can affect how the world runs. And if you think about Satan and all the technology that I really believe that he has inspired men to create, and think about what he's done with this technology, there's some good things that have happened by it, but there's also some really bad things. And you can see, I think, the roots of this way back in the very beginning. It seems that this is what, these are some of the areas that Satan started to focus his efforts on. So he was sharpening his sword while he could. But God replaced Abel with Seth. So Satan kills Abel, but then God replaces him with another godly seed. Verse 25, Genesis 4 and verse 25, and Adam knew his wife again, and she bare a son and called his name Seth. For God, said she, hath appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew. And to Seth, to him also there was born a son, and he called his name Enos. Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. So we see here that God has won the battle again. Yes, Abel was killed, but now God replaces him with Seth, and then Seth has a son, Enos, and then in those days, men begin to call upon the name of the Lord. Despite all of Satan's work that he's done up to this point, now men are calling on the name of the Lord, and Satan is losing the battle again. So comes the next area of the battle, and that is the sons of God go into the daughters of men. So Satan now has lost the battle with Abel, and now God is gaining ground here with Seth and his children, and men are calling on the name of the Lord, and Satan's got to do something about this, because now this godly religion is getting widespread, and Satan's got to try to dilute this thing down. Now I'm going to tell you what I'm going to get into next is not going to be the easiest stuff. I'm sure you've probably heard some of this before, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the sons of God going into the daughters of man. I'm going to talk about what that was. I'm going to show you from the Bible what it was and who they were and what they did. But then I also want to spend a little bit of time refuting a contrary position that says that the sons of God were somebody totally different. And then I also want to give you my reasons why I don't believe that this thing extended way out into the present day as well. And I will get into what I'm talking about. So I'm just giving you a little bit of the lay of the land here. And I just want to tell you that some of this stuff is going to be a little difficult. So you're going to have to put your thinking cap on and try to follow me. And if I lose you, then you can get the outline and you can go back over it and talk to me about it. And maybe you'll follow it. It'll be no trouble at all. But it's not going to be the most simple stuff. So men begin to call upon the name of the Lord in the days of Enos. And the chances are then increased that the promised Messiah could be born anywhere, right? So now, when it first started out, you got two people, Cain and Abel. That's pretty easy to identify. But now you got men in general calling on the name of the Lord. So you got righteous men all over the place. And the woman's seed could be any number of thousands of people, maybe even millions of people. And this thing's kind of getting out of control with Satan. So he needs to come up with another plan to destroy mankind. Because at this point, if it's so widespread, you just got to wipe them all out. Just kind of corrupt the whole thing, because you can't go after them all individually. So he would send fallen angels to the earth to marry human women and father devilish half-breeds with them, corrupting the bloodline of mankind and filling the earth with wicked sinners. This is what's going to happen here in Genesis 6:1-4. And I'll read that passage to you now, and we're going to spend the rest of the time talking about this passage. Genesis 6:1-4. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them. Remember, we read about that with Seth and Enos. They were multiplying, and men began to call on the name of the Lord. So you had some righteous men that were multiplying on the earth. That the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. This is a much disputed passage of Scripture, and there are different interpretations of it. And I'm going to give you, two well-known interpretations, and I'm going to show you why I believe that the first is false, and why the second is true. The first interpretation is that there are some out there that believe that these were the godly descendants of Seth. So the sons of God there in Genesis chapter 6 that went into the daughters of men, that these were the godly descendants of Seth. The men that I just talked about, the men that were calling upon the name of the Lord, these were the, quote, sons of God that went in unto the daughters of men. The second interpretation, or the second of the two that I'm going to cover, there could be more, is that there are some that believe that these were fallen angels. The sons of God in Genesis 6 were fallen angels. And that is the belief that I believe this passage is teaching. And I believe this for the following reasons. First of all, the phrase, the sons of God, that phrase, is only used three other places in the Bible, in the Old Testament, outside of Genesis 6. And it's always referring to angels. Now, in the New Testament, sons of God refers to the regenerate, right? But in the Old Testament, if you just take the Old Testament, the phrase sons of God, it's only ever used three other times, and it always refers to angels. I'll show you those three times. Job chapter 1 and verse 6. They're actually all in Job. Job chapter 1 and verse 6. Jonathan Crosby takes the Sethite position, but he will even admit that sons of God in Job are referring to angels. So he admits that every other place in the Old Testament, the sons of God refers to angels, but then he says it doesn't in Genesis chapter 6. And I've read his notes on this, and I did not buy his line of argumentation. Job chapter 1, verse 6. It says, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them." The sons of God present themselves before the Lord. This is speaking of in heaven, and Satan comes to present himself among them. Okay, so sons of God here are clearly referring to angels. We're not talking about men. Because he asked Satan, "Whence comest thou?" And he says, "I've been running around to and fro in the earth." Right? So this is happening in heaven where the Lord is, not on the earth. So the sons of God presenting themselves are the angels. Job 2 and verse 1. "Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord." And then in Job 38 and verse 7. Job 38 and verse 7. We looked at this passage earlier in this series. We're going to look at it again, 38:7. I'll start with verse 6. The Lord is questioning Job. It says, "Whereupon are the foundations thereof?" That's the foundations of the earth. "Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? And who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy." This is when God laid the foundation of the earth. There were no men around when God laid the foundation of the earth. He didn't make men for 6 days later, until 6 days later. The sons of God here clearly, unequivocally, undisputably, is referring to the angels. There is no other possibility that in Job 38 and verse 7 that the sons of God are angels. There's no other way, because there was no other being around in the universe except for angels. It has to be angels, sons of God. That's what Job 1 and 2 are referring to when the sons of God presented themselves before the Lord. It's the angels. Now, the angels, why would they be called the sons of God? Well, the angels, including the fallen angels, are the sons of God by creation, as was Adam. They're not sons of God by regeneration, but by creation. Look at Luke 3 and verse 38. Luke 3 and verse 38. This will give us a perfect explanation of why the angels are called the sons of God. Luke 3 and verse 38. This is the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the very tail end of it. It says, "Which was the son of Enos, which was the son of Seth, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of God." Adam was the son of God by creation. God created him, and God was his father because he caused his being to exist. The same reasoning is with the angels. They are called the sons of God because he created them. He is their father in that sense. Now I want you to think about something. If you were a Jew reading Genesis 6, 2 through 4, for hundreds of years prior to the writing of the New Testament, by comparing Scripture with Scripture, that would be the books of the Old Testament, you would have to conclude that the sons of God were angels. Because just think about it. You're a Jew, you got 1,500 years there of the Old Testament's written, and the New Testament is not existent yet, and you're looking at Genesis 6, and you're saying, "Who are the sons of God?" And you get out your concordance, which didn't exist, right? You'd have to just flip through and find all the places where sons of God exist, or where sons of God were in the Old Testament. And when you do that, every place you find in the Old Testament says it's referring to angels. So what would you conclude? The sons of God in Genesis 6 are angels, because every other place in the Bible, they're angels. That is when you're looking at the Old Testament. Now, is this possible? Could angels actually marry human women and father children by them? Because some people think, well, this is impossible. But why is it impossible? Angels can materialize and appear as human men, and they can do physical things, such as eat and other things. Let's look at Daniel 9:21, first of all. Daniel 9 and verse 21. I'll just show you that angels can materialize as men, and they can, I mean, they're physical beings at that point. Remember, angels are primarily spiritual beings, but they can manifest themselves as physical beings. Daniel 9 and verse 21. The Lord sent the angel Gabriel to Daniel to give him a message. And it says, Gabriel says, yea, whilst I was speaking in prayer, or Daniel says, yea, whilst I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in a vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. So here Daniel even calls Gabriel the man Gabriel, because Gabriel, the angel, appeared as a man. He flew from heaven to earth and he touched him. So he had a physical body, right? So by all accounts, he just looks like a regular guy, like a regular man. Does he have the same body parts as a man? Why not? He looks like a man. He's called a man. I don't have any problem believing he had the anatomy of a man. Angels can do physical things just like men can. Genesis 19, 1 through 3. They can eat food, which obviously requires a mouth, an esophagus, a stomach, a digestive tract, all that stuff. I mean, they've got the same parts that we do whenever they materialize as flesh. Genesis 19, 1 through 3. Now, there's skeptics out there that wouldn't believe this, but I don't care what skeptics think. They don't believe that there's angels anyway, so I'm not even bothering to speak to them. Genesis 19, 1 through 3. It says, and there came two angels to Sodom at even, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom, and Lot, seeing them, rose up to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the earth, and he said, behold now, my lords, turn in, I pray you, into your servant's house, and tarry all night, and wash your feet, and ye shall rise up early, and go on your ways. And they said, nay, but we will abide in the street all night. How far did I say I was going to read? Verse 3. And he pressed them upon them greatly, and they turned in unto him, and entered into his house, and he made them a feast, and did bake unleavened bread, and they did eat. The angels ate. They washed their feet. They had physical feet. They ate with their mouths. So they're doing things that men do. I would say, apparently, and I couldn't prove this, but apparently, angels are the same species as men are. They're a superior breed, kind of like St. Bernard are the same species as Chihuahuas, right? They're both dogs, but St. Bernards are clearly superior, to, I guess, depending on how you want to define superior, but they're certainly larger and more dog-like, I guess, than Chihuahuas. I guess a Chihuahua could be considered a dog. I don't know, kind of a pathetic little creature, but anyway, they are the same species, right? So angels, I would say, are the same species, and by species I would define it as not animals, but beings that can breed together, right? That's what I would define a species as. I think that's a common definition, and I would say that they have the same DNA, right? Because if an angel appears as a man, he's got a body and he's got a digestive tract and he can eat and he can speak and he can touch and all that. Well, I would assume he's got DNA running through him just like any old man does, right? So it's not a far cry or a stretch to think that angels could materialize and know human women and father children by them. I don't think that's a great stretch. Now, in Genesis 6, in chapter 1, it says that men began to multiply on the face of the earth. Let me just get that text. Genesis 6 and verse 1. Came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them. So men on the face of the earth had daughters born unto them. In Genesis 6:2, it says, when men were having daughters born unto them, the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair. Do you notice that the sons of God are set in contrast to men in Genesis 6:1 and 2, right? Men began to multiply on the face of the earth. Daughters were born unto them. The sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. So you have men in contrast with the sons of God, right? The sons of God are not men in this passage. The sons of God are in distinction to men. You see that? Now, if the sons of God were Sethites, that is, the descendants of Seth, were there no fair women among the Sethites that they could take for wives? I mean, if you think about it, if we're looking at the opponent's argument here, that the sons of God were Sethites, and you're reading this passage, and you're like, okay, so the Sethites, they see these daughters of the Canaanites, and they're fair, and they want to take them. So does that mean that there were no good-looking women among the Sethites? The Sethites couldn't just marry their own women? Like, the only beautiful women on the face of the earth were the daughters of Cain? Why would that be? That doesn't make any sense. There's no reason for that. But if you think about it, would it make sense for angels to see beautiful women and think, huh, I want to get me some of that? Because guess what? There are no women angels up in heaven, right? The sons of Seth have their own women. The angels don't have their own women. I can prove that to you. Matthew 22 and verse 30. Matthew 22 and verse 30. They probably didn't realize what was going to happen to them if they took the daughters of men. That happened afterwards. The Lord punished those angels for that. But prior to that, I mean, they're looking at a good opportunity here. Matthew 22 and verse 30. Just show you, there's no women in heaven, no women angels in heaven. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven. So the angels of God, they don't marry. And the reason is because the angels are only men. And when you read through the Bible, look at every single instance of an angel. It's always a man. You're not going to find girly angels. Now, you'll see that in the pictures that people come up with and the little figurines and all that. And you see the pictures of the angels, the little fat baby with the halo over his head and the wings and all that. That's just a bunch of foolish nonsense. That is not biblical. There are not little baby angels and there are not girly angels. There are manly angels. That's the only kind there are. So this makes Genesis 6:2 make more sense for the fallen angel position than the Sethite position. Because, you know, why would the sons of Seth need to go after women of another family? I mean, they've got their own women. But angels, yeah, they don't have their own women. Makes a lot more sense. Now, if the sons of God in Genesis 6, 2, and 4 were the godly Sethites, and the daughters of men were the wicked Cainites, why would their offspring then, with those alleged wicked women, be giants and mighty men of renown? Remember Genesis 6 and verse 4? It says there that the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men were giants. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. So, if these are Sethites, and they're marrying Cainites, why would the descendants of that marriage, why would they be giants? Why would they be mighty men of renown? Is there any particular reason for that? Because these are just human beings breeding with human beings. Why would their byproduct be these giants and these men of renown? I don't see any reason for that. Why would they have been any different than any other human children? Why would the other children of the Sethites not be giants? Right? If the Sethites have some giant gene in them, right? Why wouldn't their giant gene be passed down to their own daughters of men that they were breeding with? You know, so why wouldn't all of their children, not just the ones with the daughters of men, why wouldn't they be giants? Jude speaks of angels that kept not their first estate, which is their normal state or their nature. I'll define that in a second. And left their habitation, even as, in like manner as, the men of Sodom and Gomorrah, who gave themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh. Let me read that passage to you. I'm going to define some terms, and we're going to see here that Jude 1, 6, and 7 is referring to the same thing that is referring to what happened in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. And this gives us further proof that these sons of God were angels breeding with human women. Jude 1, 6 through 7. Jude 1, 6 through 7. It says, "And the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness, under the judgment of the great day, even as, in like manner, Sodom and Gomorrah, and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth for an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire." These two events here, the angels and Sodom and Gomorrah, are set in contrast to each other, not really in likeness to each other. The same exact thing was happening here. Angels left their first estate, they're reserved in everlasting chains under darkness. They're in hell. Sodom and Gomorrah went after strange flesh, right? Went after flesh, went after people, and men in this case, that they had no business going after, and they're in hell, right? Angels commit a sexual sin, they're in hell. Sodom and Gomorrah commit a sexual sin, they're in hell. You see, it's the same thing. It's or a similar thing. Estate. It says there, the angels which kept not their first estate. Now, we think of an estate as all the land and all the stuff that you own, right? No. I mean, that is a definition, but it's not the primary definition. Primary definition of estate in the Oxford English Dictionary is state or condition in general, whether material or moral, bodily or mental, in modern English, which is the King James Bible English, it means constitution, nature. It's almost exclusively used in biblical phrases, it says. Constitution or nature. The angels which kept not their first nature. Their nature as spiritual beings, right? Spiritual bodies staying up in heaven, doing what they're supposed to do. They didn't keep their first estate. They left their constitution or their nature, materialized as flesh, and took women that they weren't supposed to take. Sodom and Gomorrah, going after fornication, gave themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh. Strange is of persons, language, customs, etc., of or belonging to another country, foreign, alien. You see, Sodom and Gomorrah went after foreign or alien flesh. The angels did the same type of thing, even as, right? Same thing, foreign or alien flesh. You see it? I don't think it could be made much more plain here in the scripture. So in other words, some of the fallen angels left their constitution and nature and went after strange flesh, that's human women, even as, in like manner, the men of Sodom did to the people or to the men who were not given to them. So I think here it's pretty clear when you put Genesis 6 compared with Jude chapter 1, we see what's going on here. So putting it all together, I'm convinced that the sons of God that went in under the daughters of men were fallen angels that materialized into human bodies and had sex with human women and created superhuman offspring. Makes sense to me. I mean, let's go back to the St. Bernard and the Chihuahua example. I can't imagine how this would happen, but let's just say a St. Bernard and a Chihuahua bred together. I would imagine that if you're looking at it from the vantage point of the Chihuahua, you're going to have a very large Chihuahua baby, right? You're going to, or baby, whatever, puppy. So the more superior part of the species mating with the less superior ends up creating animal or a product that is far superior to the lesser one, right? St. Bernard and the Chihuahua. The same thing would be with the angels. Whenever you have a far superior angel mating with an inferior human woman, the product would not surprise me if it was a giant, if it was a man of renown, a mighty man, some superhuman type of person with qualities that are above and beyond the average human being. Not a far stretch for me. Now, in that the angels that did so were bound in everlasting chains under the judgment day, Jude 1:6, I am not convinced it's still happening today. So the information that we have about this event is in Genesis chapter 6, that it happened. And then in Jude chapter 1, we're told that the angels that did that in Genesis chapter 6 are locked up in everlasting chains under darkness. Okay, that's the information that we're given. So for me to take that information, it happened, the angels that did that are now in hell, and that's all the information I have? It's too much of a stretch to me to say, well, it just kept on happening and it's happening today. I don't think it's still happening today because for the reasons I just gave. It happened. The angels that did it are in prison. It's not happening anymore. That's what I would say. Now, there are some that argue that the breeding of fallen angels with human women continued after the flood and continues to this day. They base their argument on the following. So there's three main arguments that they use for this. They argue that the phrase in Genesis 6:4, and also after that phrase, means that the angel-human crossbreeding continued after the flood. Let's just go back there and read that. Genesis 6 and verse 4. I'm going to talk about this argument in just a second. I'm going to go into it in great detail, but I'll just give you the argument first of all. Genesis 6:4, there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that. Right. So they say, not only in those days, but after that, after the flood and going on throughout history, there were giants in the earth. Right. That's the argument. Secondly, they argue that because the angel-human offspring before the flood were giants, that the giants in the land of Canaan after the flood were also products of the same breeding. So the argument goes like this. You had angels breeding with women and creating giants before the flood. And then after the flood in the land of Canaan, we read of more giants. So therefore, the giants after the flood must have been created the same way as the giants before the flood. That's how the argument goes. And I'll give you just a couple of verses which shows that there were indeed giants in the land of Canaan. Numbers 13 and verse 33. Numbers 13 and verse 33. I'll give you my argument against this point in just a second, but I'm just going to give you this point first. Numbers 13 and verse 33. It says, "And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight." So this is whenever they went to spy out the land in the land of Canaan, and they found these giants, these really large people. Deuteronomy 2, 10 through 11 is another one, and there's several places here in the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 2, 10 and 11. It says, "The Emims dwelt therein in times past, a people great and many and tall as the Anakims, which also were accounted giants as the Anakims, but the Moabites call them Emims." So here are some people that were giants in the land of Canaan there. The third argument is that they argue that in the days leading up to the coming of Christ, it will be like it was in the days of Noah, and therefore there will be angel-human half-breeds roaming the earth, is the argument. And they use the verse Matthew 24 and verse 37 to substantiate this claim. Matthew 24, 37. Matthew 24 and verse 37. This is in the Olivet Discourse. Jesus said, "But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." So they say that, yep, it's when Jesus returns, it's going to be just like it was in the days of Noah. In the days of Noah, there's a bunch of angelic half-breeds running around. That's what it's going to be like in the end days as well. Now, these arguments are all found wanting in my estimation. The following is my refutation of these arguments. The first one, that there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men. Okay, so let's look at that passage there, Genesis 6 and verse 4. Genesis 6 and verse 4. So the giants in the earth in those days. Those days refers to the days up to the time that the Lord said that he would not strive with man and vowed to destroy them in 120 years. You can see that if you read verse 3 in context with verse 4. In verse 3, it says, "And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be in 120 years. I used to think a long, long time ago before I was ever baptized that this passage was referring to the length of men's lives on the earth would be limited to 120 years. That they lived for 900 and some, now they're going to limit it to 120, and then later on Solomon says it's 70 or 80. This is not what that's talking about. That his days shall be 120 years. The length of time that men had on the earth was going to be 120 years from when God made that decree. They had 120 years left and God was going to flood the earth, right? That would be men's days that are left on the earth. Because he's not, let's look at the context. He's not always going to strive with man, right? He's got 120 years left, and I'm not striving with him anymore. He's done. There were giants in the earth in those days, okay? So those days are referring to the days that led up to the time when the Lord said he would not strive with men anymore, okay? Those days were the days when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and the sons of God took them wives. Genesis 6, 1 and 2. So the giants in the earth in those days were the days when men began to multiply on the earth and that the sons of God took them wives and had these children. Now this could have been happening hundreds of years before God pronounced his judgment on the earth. Remember, men began to multiply on the earth from the very beginning, right? Especially whenever Seth was born, and then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. I mean, they were multiplying on the earth, and that was hundreds and hundreds of years before this. It was 1,656 years from creation until the flood, okay? This is 120 years before the flood, right? So you're talking 1,500 and some years, 1,530 some years took place from the creation until God said, I'm not going to strive with man anymore. 1,500 years. Men had been multiplying on the earth for 1,500 years prior to God saying, I'm done. I'm done with man. I'm going to destroy him in 120 years, right? It was when men began to multiply on the face of the earth that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, right? So the sons of God, it wasn't like they did it the day before the flood. They'd been doing it when man began to multiply, and that had been going on for hundreds of years. Men had begun to multiply on the face of the earth from the beginning of time, and the sons of God took them wives when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, not hundreds of years after men began to multiply. Therefore, those days, there in 6:4, were not the 120 years in Genesis 6:3, because there were already giants in the earth when God decreed that he would destroy man in 120 years. That's why he decreed it. The reason God decreed he was going to destroy the earth was because of this problem there with the half-breeds and all the wickedness that was in the earth as a result of that. So the days, those days in verse 4 are not referring to those 120 years from the time God decreed it until the flood. They're referring to the time prior to that. Therefore, I maintain that the phrase "and also after that" in Genesis 6:4 refers to the 120 years between God's decree and the flood. So there are giants in the earth in those days, from the time men began to multiply on the earth. For a long time there were giants in the earth, and also after that, after God made the decree that men had only 120 years left, after that decree, there were also giants in the earth. The giants continued to, the angels continued to create giants on the earth after God made the decree for 120 years. I maintain this because Genesis 6:4 identifies the time period of that phrase and also after that as being when the sons of God came in under the daughters of men, which happened before the flood, not after the flood, right? Genesis 6:4, there were giants in the earth in those days and also after that when the sons of God came in under the daughters of men. Well, the sons of God came in under the daughters of men before the flood, right? Not after the flood. That's why I maintain that. Furthermore, the giants that were produced and also after that in the 120 year period were mighty men which were of old. So the men that were the giants that were produced after the Lord decreed to destroy the earth in that 120 year period, they were called men which were of old. Let's read verse 4 again. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. So the ones that were the giants that were created after that, and also after that, were called men which were of old. Okay? Just remember that. Men which were of old. These are the ones that were created and after that, right? Moses wrote Genesis long after the flood, about 850 years afterward, and he said that the giants that were produced also after that were mighty men which were of old, not mighty men of today. So you think about when Moses wrote this. He wrote this 850 years later, right? Now, there were giants running around in the land of Canaan when Moses wrote Genesis, right? I just read you. There were giants running around in the land of Canaan. But the giants that Genesis 6:4 refers to, Moses called men which were of old. Like, these men were around a long time ago, right? Moses is writing 850 years after Genesis 6:4 happened, right? The words were recorded long after they actually happened. So Moses, referring to these men, says they were of old, not today. Not the giants that are running around in Canaan today, but they were men of old. They were men a long, long time ago, right? In other words, the sons of God married women and produced giants prior to the time that God decreed man's destruction, and also after that, until God destroyed the world with the flood, which was long before Moses wrote Genesis of old. Now, it's possible that the cause of the giants in the land of Canaan were fallen angels breeding with women. It's possible. I'm not saying it's not impossible. If they did it once, they could do it again, I suppose. I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibility. But based on my comments above, I do not think that Genesis 6:4 details the origin of the giants in Canaan. but rather that the giants that continued to be produced up until the time of the flood. So here's my thing. If the giants in the land of Canaan were the product of angels breeding with fallen women or with human women, I do not believe that it is because of what Genesis 6:4 says. Genesis 6:4 is not referring to that. If that happened, it's not because of what Genesis 6:4 says. Genesis 6:4 is referring to what happened before the flood, not after the flood. I'm not saying it's impossible that the giants in the land of Canaan could be angelic half-breeds, but I don't have any biblical evidence for it as the thing. If the Canaanite giants came from fallen angels, it's not because of what was written in Genesis 6:4, as I see it anyway. The argument proves too much that says that because the cause of the giants in Genesis 6 was fallen angels breeding with women, then the cause of the giants in the land of Canaan must also be the same. Because that's the argument, right? If the giants prior to the flood were a result of fallen angels, then the giants after the flood are a result of fallen angels. But you know what? That argument proves too much. It doesn't have to prove that. The cause of the mighty men of renown there in Genesis 6:4 were the fallen angels, right? Let me read that to you again. We're going to look at a different key in on a different phrase here that we haven't looked at before. There were giants in the earth in those days and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. So here's the deal. If the fallen angels producing the giants in the land of Canaan, right, if the fallen angels, let me say this again. If giants must be a result of fallen angels breeding with women, if that's the only way that a giant can come about on the earth, right, then the only way that a mighty man of renown can come about is by the same method, by fallen angels. The only way that, mighty men of renown, mighty men of old or men of renown, either one of those, they would have to come about by fallen angels. So we're doing the old reasoning where we say if it proves anything, it proves too much. So by the reasoning of this argument, all mighty men and all men of renown must be the product of fallen angels breeding with women, right? Now you come into a problem because you have clearly in the Bible mighty men and men of renown, which we know were not the product of fallen angels. So if mighty men and men of renown in the Bible are not the product of angels, then you can't necessarily say that giants in the land of Canaan are the product of fallen angels, right? Because if one has to be, then the other one has to be. So let me ask you, were David's mighty men angelic half-breeds? 2 Samuel 23:8 through 22. I'm not going to read the whole passage to you. I'll just read a couple of ones that calls them mighty men. 2 Samuel 23:8 through 22. It says, these be the names of the mighty men whom David had. The Tachmonite that sat in the seat, chief among the captains. The same was Adino. The Eznite, he lift up his spear against 800 men whom he slew at one time. And after him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahohite, one of the three mighty men with David when he defied the Philistines that were gathered together to battle. And the men of Israel were gone away. He arose and smote the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand clave under the sword. And the Lord wrought a great victory in that day. And the people returned after him only to spoil. And then he goes on to talk about these other guys and they did these great feats. And they were called mighty men. Now, if giants can only be created by fallen angels, that means that mighty men can only be created by fallen angels. Because the result of the fallen angels in Genesis 6:4 resulted in giants who were mighty men, right? Well, these mighty men of David clearly weren't Nephilim, as they call them. They were not fallen angel half-breeds or something. These were David's good guys. Were the princes of Israel, who were called men of renown, were they angelic half-breeds? How about Numbers 16 and verse 2? Numbers 16 and verse 2. See, I told you it was going to be difficult material because it's difficult for me to get it all said in the right order sometimes as well. Numbers 16 and verse 2. I should have wrote it down in a syllogism. That would have made it easier. Numbers 16. I don't know if I said 6, but I meant 16. Numbers 16, 2. And they arose, or they rose up before Moses with certain of the children of Israel, 250 princes of the assembly, famous in the congregation, men of renown. Same exact phrase in Genesis 6, 4. Were these great men in the congregation of Israel, were they all Nephilim? Right? The Nephilim is the word that people use to refer to the angelic half-breeds. I think it's the Hebrew word for giants. This is where they get that word. But obviously, these men famous in the congregation, men of renown, were not Nephilim, right? So therefore, we can't say that the giants in the land of Canaan were Nephilim, right? You can't make that statement that just because they're giants, that means they're Nephilim. Well, if that's the case, then just because they're men of renown means they're Nephilim. Was the nation of Israel, whose renown was known among the heathen, angelic half-breeds? And I'm not going to go there, but in Ezekiel 16, 14 through 15, it talks about Israel's renown being known among the nations. The answer to these questions is, of course, no. Just as Genesis 6, 4 doesn't demand that the mighty men of David and the men of renown in Israel were angelic half-breeds, neither does it demand that the giants in Canaan were either. Now, it's also possible that the giants in the land of Canaan were just a bigger variety of people. So where did the giants in Canaan come from? If they weren't angelic half-breeds, then why were there giants, right? Well, just a simple explanation, they could just be a bigger variety of people. Bolivians, who are the shortest people on the average, their average height is 4'11.5". If they were visiting the Netherlands, which are the tallest people on the earth, the average height is 6 foot. They would likely go home and tell of the, quote, giants they saw. I mean, they're over a foot taller, right? That could be how Set felt whenever she got here. You know, the land of giants here. We're not all Nephilim, though, Set, believe me. We're not all angelic half-breeds here. We just happen to be a larger breed of people than the people in the Philippines. This could be the same case with the Canaanites. They could have just been a larger breed of people, that's all. Sometimes the simplest explanation is the best. It's called Holcomb's razor, I think. I think that's Holcomb's razor. The simplest explanation is the best. Now, should we conclude that every rare giant that we see today is a product of a fallen angel? I mean, if you're going to say that the giants in the land of Canaan had to be products of fallen angels, then you'd have to say that every giant you see today is the product of a fallen angel, right? I mean, if the only way that a giant can come about is through a fallen angel, then the giants today are products of fallen angels, right? You see how this could be problematic? I have a friend in Cincinnati who's 6'8". The guy was enormous. He was huge. I had a Chevy Cavalier at the time. He got into my car with a seat the whole way back in the passenger seat. And not that his knees were on the dash, the middle of his shins were on the dash. I don't think the guy could have actually driven my car. He literally could not have fit into the driver's seat of the car. There was not enough room in there for him to actually get in there and get his legs straightened out. He was huge, or is huge. But by this argument's reasoning, I'd have to conclude that he's a Nephilim, right? I don't think he's a Nephilim. I know the guy pretty well. I mean, he's a nice guy. I don't think he's a Nephilim. As far as I know, he didn't have, you know, Lucifer for his father or anything like that. But that's the kind of reasoning that you'd have to end up taking on. You'd have to say that every giant we see today is a Nephilim. Using Matthew 24:37, that's the third argument, remember, where it would be like it was in the days of Noah. If you're going to use that to prove that there will be fallen angel human half-breeds roaming the earth at the end times, that's just an example of poor Bible interpretation. Because if you look at Matthew 24:37, look at the context of it. The context of it is not Nephilim or anything else. The context is that nobody knows the date or the time of the second coming. Matthew 24 and verse 36. Matthew 24 and verse 36. Jesus said, "But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noe were, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be." You see, he's talking about the time of the second coming, okay? That's the context. Nobody knows the date or the hour or the time. Now, just as the people who lived in the days before the flood had no idea what was coming, and went on their merry ways, eating and drinking and marrying until the day that the flood came and destroyed them all, so it will be for those living in the day when Jesus Christ returns. They'll have no idea it's coming, and they'll be going about their normal lives until it happens. Verses 38 and 39. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark. See, no mention of the angels coming down and creating giants or anything. What Jesus is focusing in on is that prior to the flood, men were just going about their merry way, eating, drinking, marrying. They're just living life. They're just you know, enjoying themselves. No mention. The context is not the fallen angels breeding with women. Verse 39, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. That's what he's referring to, that the coming of the Son of Man will be like it was in the days of Noah. Men are going to be eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage. People are just going to be going about their lives. They're going to be saying peace and safety. They're not going to know that it's right around the corner until the day. One day, the heavens are going to break open. They're going to hear a loud trumpet, the last trumpet, and Jesus Christ is going to come back and judge the world, and it's too late and it's over. Just like it happened in the days of Noah. It's not referring to what happened there in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. This is not the context at all. That's why I say it's poor Bible interpretation. Matthew 24, 37 has nothing whatsoever to do with the sons of God going in under the daughters of men and fathering half-breed giants. Now, it is true that Jude 1, 6 doesn't prevent fallen angels from breeding with human women again. Right? Jude 1, 6 definitely says that the angels that did breed with the women that left their first estate, that they are locked up in chains under darkness until the judgment of the great day. So there's no doubt about it. The angels that did that, those particular angels, they're definitely not going to do it again because they're locked up down there, right? So they won't. But there are a whole bunch of other fallen angels that potentially could do it again, right? So Jude 1:6 doesn't prevent it from happening again and says that it will never happen again with different angels, right? So I'm not saying that. But I would say that given the two positions, position number one, that it happened in Genesis 6 and those angels were locked up in hell and it didn't happen again, or position number two, that it began to happen in Genesis chapter 6 and continues to happen until the end of time, and only the angels in Genesis 6 were locked up in hell. So given those two positions, it seems that Jude 1:6 lends more support for position one, since it speaks in the past tense, the angels that kept not their first estate, but left their habitation, right? It doesn't say the angels that keep not their first estate and leave their own habitation, but the angels that kept and left. It's referring to what happened in the past, and those angels are locked up. So I would say, given the two positions, either that it happened, it's done and over with, and they're locked up, or that it happened and it's continuing to happen, I would say that of those two positions, Jude 1:6 clearly lends itself to the first one, that it happened, they're locked up, it's not happening again, spoken of in the past tense, not in the present tense, not continuing to happen. The angels that did so were, as the men of Sodom were, set forth for an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire, Jude 1:7. So when you think about it, they are set forth for an example. Like the men of Sodom were, so are the angels that did the sin. They're an example. So to me, that would say that the Lord said, hey, you other angels out there, look at those guys. That's what happened to them. You're not going to do that because this is what's happening to you. So it would, when you put all that together, it certainly seems to indicate that it's not something that's ongoing. Not saying it's impossible that it could be. I'm just saying that I have not seen the biblical evidence for it is what I'm saying. Now, I do have just a couple of questions for those that would disagree with the position that I just made here. Genesis 6:4 seems to indicate that the giants were common on earth before the flood. It's when you read through Genesis 6:1-4, it seems like that the average guy just saw giants running around. I mean, it was just a commonplace thing. There were giants in the earth in those days. They weren't, you know, secretly hiding in caves or something. If it is still happening today, why are giants so rare today? Why don't we see great big men all over the place? You know, 8-9 footers especially, like the real big ones that there are. There is the occasional one, but why aren't there giants roaming around? Why is the average guy that you see today probably between 5'8" and 6' or something like that? Why don't you see the great big guys running all around? Since the giants were mighty men and men of renown, in other words, powerful leaders of the earth, why aren't today's powerful leaders of the earth giants if Genesis 6:4 is still happening, right? If the giants were men of renown and the mighty men, the powerful people, why aren't the powerful people today giants, right? Donald Trump's not a giant. Barack Obama wasn't a giant, right? Abe in Japan's not a giant. Merkel's not a giant, right? In Germany, all these leaders of the world today, they're not giants. Why aren't they giants? Now, I can already predict the answer. If the answer is that the leaders we see are just puppets, right? And I agree with that. I'm not disputing that. Then where are the giants who are pulling the strings, right? If the giants are really the movers and shakers and the ones behind the scenes, okay, where are they? You know, the Rockefellers or the Soros or whoever, I'm sure there's people behind them. You know, the Jews, what are the Rothschilds, couldn't think of it. The Rothschilds. I'm not ever rubbing shoulders with Rothschilds, but as far as I know, they're not 9 foot tall Nephilims running around, right? Okay, so there's probably guys behind the Rothschilds. Okay, I'm just asking, where are the giants? That's all I want to know. If it's happening today and in Genesis 6:4 is ongoing, where are the giants? That's all I want to know. The giants in Genesis 6:4 seem to have been out in the open for all to see. Why is that not the case today if it's still happening? And I think that's a legitimate question to ask. I'm not trying to be mean, but that's a legitimate question to ask. Now, this plan of crossbreeding fallen angels with human women was almost entirely successful. I mean, getting back to the war here, it was a genius plan because he filled the earth with violence. He filled the earth with wickedness, and the Lord was so fed up with it, he destroyed mankind. It was really quite the plan. The earth was corrupt and full of wickedness and violence, so much so that God decreed that he would destroy all mankind with the exception of Noah and his family. You see, but this is where Satan couldn't foresee everything. He figures if I fill the earth with violence, maybe God will just get fed up and kill everybody. But what he didn't realize is there's just that one holdout. There's that one righteous guy, and the Lord is going to spare him and his family. Satan almost had him. Genesis 6, 5 through 13. Genesis 6, 5 through 13. It's interesting to look back through time and think of how many times Satan almost won. He kills Adam and Eve. Looks like, hey, he's got them. Nope, God's got another plan. Eve has two kids. He kills one of them and the other one's one of his children. Well, good so far. He's almost got them. Nope. Then he floods the earth with these half-breeds and creates all of an earth full of violence and wickedness. And God destroys the entire earth except for 8 people. Almost 8 people, except for 8 people. And you realize that there were probably millions of people on earth at that time. And people have done the math. Do the math. If you had Adam and Eve, and they had at least, it said that they had sons and daughters beside, and if you just do the bare minimum, sons and daughters, and that was after they had Cain and Seth at least. And I forget they had to have at least 7 or 8 kids to have sons and daughters, but they probably had a lot more than that because they lived for hundreds and hundreds of years. So you take people that were living for hundreds of years and having children way into their, you know, I don't know how, I mean, Noah, well, he was 500 years old, whatever, he had his kids or around that age. So when you take a guy that's fertile from age 20 to age, 500, and just imagine how many kids you could have. And then just do the logarithmic regression, there could have been millions and millions of people on earth. And there were 8 righteous. So Satan, he's not God. He's not omniscient, right? He's looking around and thinking, I got them all. I mean, the whole earth is just full of wickedness. And God yet has his little remnant. And Satan wasn't able to win the battle again. Anyway, Genesis 6, 5 through 13. Genesis 6, 5 through 13. And the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. And I'm sure if Satan knew what God was thinking, I don't know if God said this out loud or not, Satan's thinking, great, he's going to kill them all. I've won. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Darn. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. And Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, and for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. But the Lord ended up saving Noah. He saved Noah, his wife, and his three sons, and their three wives in Genesis 7:7, and he killed the rest of mankind with a flood. Genesis 7 and verse 7, and Noah went in, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him into the ark because of the waters of the flood. And in verse 21, it says, and all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowl, and of cattle, and of beast, and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and every man. Now, right there is a good verse that you can remember whenever you're talking to Arminians, and they like to say that Jesus tasted death for every man. That means every single human being that's ever existed. This says that every man died on the earth, but we know that there were eight that didn't, right? We know that every man was a qualified every man in that passage. And you know what? Many times, in fact, most times, the majority of times, whenever the Bible uses the word all men, the world, or every man, it's almost, not always, but many times, more than not, referring to a specific part of mankind. It's not referring to the whole of mankind. But that's another story for another day. So God had once again outsmarted Satan. The devil's now back to the drawing board, having to figure out which of the sons of Noah the prophesied Messiah would come through. Remember, it's the seed of the woman, and Noah and his wife, and their sons and their wives are all the seed of the woman, right? They all come from Eve, so it's going to be one of them, or if it's not one of them, it's going to be one of their children. And now he's got to figure out, okay, I've got three families that it could be, Shem, Ham, or Japheth. Which one's it going to be? So he's back to the drawing board again. Now Noah had cursed the descendants of Ham and blessed both Shem and Japheth. So this gives the devil a little bit of an idea, maybe who to go after. In Genesis 9, 24 through 25, this is after Noah got off the ark and he made himself a vineyard and he made himself some wine, and he drank too much wine and he became drunk and he was laying in his tent naked, and Ham went in there and saw his father naked and came back out, and I assume snickering about it, kind of poking fun, hey guys, look at dad, what a fool. And Seth and Japheth, they went into the tent backward, took a garment with them, and covered up their father to not see his shame. Well, when Noah woke up and found out what Ham had done, he cursed him. It says there in Genesis 9, 24 and 25, and Noah woke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. And he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. Ham is the father of Canaan. But then he blesses Shem. I said Seth, I meant Shem. He blesses Shem and Japheth. Genesis 9, 26 and 27. And he said, blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and shall dwell, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. So Shem and Japheth are blessed, and Canaan, or Ham, that's the descendants of Ham, are going to be their servants. So there's a pretty good indication to Satan. At least he's got two out of three, or he's got one out of three out of the way, and he's got it narrowed down to two out of the three. Pretty clear that the Messiah is either going to come through Shem or Japheth, but not through Ham. Now, of course, we know that the Messiah did come through Shem, but the devil didn't know that yet. So it appears that Satan started working through the descendants of Ham to build his empire through Nimrod, who founded the kingdom of Babel, later to be called the infamous Babylon. And I'll end here in Genesis chapter 10, 6 through 10. So it appears, remember whenever Satan killed, Abel, couldn't think of his name, killed Abel, and he had Cain left, and then Satan gets busy working with the descendants of Cain to try to, you know, to muster up his army and to get ready for the next battle. What is it appears here that Satan is now working through the descendants of Ham to do the same thing. He's getting his, he's building up for the next battle. Genesis 6, 6 through 10. And the sons of Ham, Cush and Mizraim and Phut and Canaan, and the sons of Cush, Seba and Havilah and Sabta and Raamah and Sabtika, and the sons of Raamah, Sheba, and Dedan, and Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calne in the land of Shinar. So we've all heard of Nimrod before, and the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom was Babel. And that's the next thing that we're going to talk about, is the Tower of Babel, because this is the next battleground where Satan is again trying to destroy mankind and trying to create an army to war against the God of heaven. So I hope that was all clear enough for you. Like I said, if it wasn't clear enough for you, if some of those arguments were a little difficult to follow because I did not bring them forth quite as clearly as I could have, you can go back through the outline where they're spelled out pretty clearly. And if you have any questions, you can always certainly ask me.